Capital Region. This is your host, H. Bosch Jr., the hippest, hottest, baddest host in America. And guess what? Tonight, I'm all by myself. So are you ready to clap your hands in the stand, move your feet in the seat, and you better believe it ain't nothing but a news thing. So here we go. First up, tonight, we're going to learn about the subsurface irrigation and framing in the face of climate change. Then we have another episode of the Triple E's with Terry Dean Patterson. After that, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry reports from the Underground Railroad History Project Liberty Con 2019 conference. And we'll close with the sanctuary's own Imani, My Right Arm Taylor, an EP in our technology series. So right now, first up, some rapid on-fire headlines. According to the Times Union, the Environmental Protection Agency has cleared the General Electric of its responsibility for cleaning up PCBs from the Hudson River, saying that $1.7 billion 2002 cleanup agreement has been satisfied. As a result, GE will not be required to continue dredging in the Hudson. New York State, with the support of Governor Cuomo and the new Attorney General-elect Letitia James announced plans to sue the EPA, saying that the decision is contrary to the law and could make it much harder for the EPA to require GE to implement more dredging or other remedial measures in the upper Hudson River. A lengthy study published last year by the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation found that the cleanup of contamination in the upper Hudson River is incomplete and not protected of public health and environment. The New York State Committee will be focusing a review of local public authorities empowered to issue tax breaks. Ooh, I could use one of those. And handout grants recently solicited information from authorities across the state will be used to judge compliance with anti-corruption laws. A recent report from the New York State Authority's budget office found dozens of red flags, including authorities who failed to file at least one required financial report related to public money. The probe is intended to enforce transparency, oversight, and accountability. A Superfund contamination site that has polluted Hoosick Falls public water supply will commence with a cleanup this spring, according to the Department of Environmental Conservation. The cleanup will include installing granular activated carbon filtration vessels to treat extracted groundwater and remove PFOA contamination. The 6.4-acre property at 14 McCaffrey Street was declared a Superfund site in 2017. It is currently a manufacturing plant operated by St. Gobain Performance Plastics, PFOA, or, perfluorocarbonic acid. Say that five times fast, which has been linked to the kidney and testicular cancer, thyroid diseases, and other serious health problems, was used at the plant for decades, including by companies that operated the plant before St. Gobain purchased it in the late 1990s. The facility was built in 1961, according to the Times Union. All right. Now, for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Station. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or just warm regards, I always have warm regards, don't I, Alexis? Email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Okay, let's go to our first segment, all right? All right, our first segment is water management is one of the most important aspects of farming, not just avoiding too much or too little, but getting it just right most of the time. Climate change is making that harder than ever. Our next guest segment reveals that.
This is Dave Pueblo, and I am at the 2019 NOFA conference in Saratoga Springs. And who am I sitting with?
I'm Larry Gehring, and I'm with the Department of Biological Environmental Engineering at Cornell University.
I just sat through your presentation on subsurface irrigation. Tell me a little bit, just a quick overview about what your presentation was about.
Well, my presentation was about subsurface drainage and how to go through the process of evaluating whether or not you need it, planning and implementation aspects, some of the construction aspects, cost benefits. My opening part was a little bit of a primer on soil water holding capacity and why it might be important to have subsurface drainage. There's a very good website that the United States Department of Agriculture and Natural Resource Conservation Service has. It's called Web Soil Survey. If you Google that, you can get right on there. You can find out what kind of soils you have and what the drainage status is. And if you have some of these poorly drained soils where the water table is very close to the surface and impacting your cropping and tillage operations, it gives you some information on how to plan whether this is something that might work for my soil conditions.
Now, when you're assisting farmers, do you do site visits yourself and give them an estimate of what they might need?
I have done that in the past, but I don't do that anymore. We're really geared to providing the research and the education as opposed to the actual on-site contractual services. So usually for that, I would recommend the landowner to reach out to their local soil and water district or to contractors who might be working in their area who could make some site evaluation and plans.
And in terms of the farmers who approach you for assistance, is it small farmers or large farmers or all types?
All types.
How maybe has this evolved over the last couple decades? I'm especially thinking in terms of maybe younger farmers coming around interested in more organic practices and maybe also the decline of dairy farms in the area. How have you seen these drainage issues evolve?
They've evolved a lot around the environmental concerns for drainage, where 4,000 years before BC, they started doing drainage and recognizing the importance of being able to lower the water table in the soil. But over time, as that has evolved, some folks realize that you might be draining wetland types of soils and that changing that habitat. And so there's always been a battle of should we drain this area or should we not drain this area. Back in about 1977, the federal government used to cost share putting drainage systems in. But then the wetland rules came out in the Farm Bill in 1985 that you cannot, they call it swamp buster, where you're not supposed to go in and drain certain kinds of wet soils or wetlands. So drainage was really, a lot of it went after World War II and up to the mid-70s. There was a lot of activity improving drainage on the farm and with federal cost sharing. But after that Farm Bill went in and the wetland rules came in, there was less interest in use of drainage. And then over the years, especially with some of the kinds of monocropping systems we have now with high fertility use, high manure use, there's also been some water quality issues related to drainage. And so that again has kind of limited some of the work that's been done. But now I'm beginning to see with the wet seasons that we're starting to see more and more of in the last decade that the interest in putting drains on the farms is picking up again. And hopefully if they do it, at least they can take into account the negative impacts of it too, because there's both positive and negative impacts to doing drainage.
Certainly, I know what you're talking about with increased risk of flood, but there's been also drought in this area. So are people looking for maybe the same thing that people were looking for 4,000 years ago by putting in swales, some sort of system that would try and buffer the impact of weather extremes?
I think when it comes to soil water management, usually they look at it separately, where we either need to remove water from the soil or we need to add it. And it's usually been talked about in two different venues. For the fields that are really wet, you know, we talk about the drainage, then there's other fields and times of year when fields are droughty. So we talk about irrigation. It can be done, not very easily, but it can be done in a drainage sub-irrigation composite system. But it's not suited to all areas, especially not a lot of the sloping soil conditions that we have in here in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm. Plus, you were talking about, I think you mentioned in your presentation, that certain types of crops where they're transplanted and they have fairly shallow root systems aren't really helped by this.
Yes, the sub-irrigation is basically a method where you're raising the water table by closing the drainage system and allowing the water table to come back up close to the surface. And so when you do that, you're bringing water up from the bottom, but you usually don't want to raise it so high that it's within inches or an inch or two of the soil surface where new transplant roots would be. And so since those transplants are also sensitive to drought, you really need some form of watering that topsoil without keeping water in the whole profile.
Maybe one last subject to bring up, but this could be a big one potentially. You had talked about some of the changes over time in terms of the actual pipes that are put in, and it's, you know, gone from ceramics and metal over to a plastic kind of thing. Maybe tell me a little bit about the impact of technology, both positive and negative, that you're dealing with these days.
Good question, and it's kind of hard to answer that one. In the years before even clay tile and plastics, landowners would use large stones the size of chicken eggs and pieces of wood planks to create channels in the subsoil for draining the water out. That changed with the advent of recognizing that you could take clay tile or clay pieces of clay and form them into pipes. And so then the clay tile took over, and that probably occurred in about the mid-1800s here in the Northeast, or in the U.S., actually. In fact, one of the first tiles was put in Geneva, New York, a clay tile where John Johnston brought a piece of clay tile over from Sweden, I believe it is, and put it in his farm south of Geneva. And so that started the clay tile use in drainage. Then in the 60s, about the early 1960s, with the advent of plastics and the ability to extrude plastics, there was that shift from clay to the plastics. Some people will argue that clay is still better. It was a very durable material, more naturally friendly, using natural materials, clays and so on, as opposed to synthetic resins that make the plastic. But now a lot of the plastic piping material is actually made from recycled plastics. There's a blend of, they can blend recycled plastics into the plastics, so they are, the current use of plastics is kind of also helping recycle some of our waste plastics.
Do you ever see people that want to try and use older methods like tiles, and they're frustrated because they can't, or is that still a possibility?
It's not possibility, because I don't think clay tiles are made anymore. I think there might be one company in Ohio that's still making them, maybe one in Canada. But being able to get a hold of clay is difficult now because it's not made. The other aspect is the clay pipe was very heavy, so if you do have to transport it any long distance and handle it, there's more labor and
cost prohibitive.
Cost issues, yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we're just about out of time. Is there any other thing that you'd want to maybe talk to farmers about that would be helpful?
Well, I think with the advent of climate change, which is one of the things this conference is about, is looking to, if we are going to continue with this change of our climate where we're seeing wetter seasons and more extreme precipitation events, it might be worthwhile to take a good look at your land resource and how you might have to adapt to that, and the possibility that maybe you may need some drainage to deal with the wetter climate if you want to continue to do things the way you'd like to.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up is our roaming labor correspondent, Mr. Willie Terry, talks about the Underground Railroad. Mr. Willie Terry attended the Underground Railroad History Project, LibertyCon 2019 conference, seeking sanctuary, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness at Siena College on March 29th to the 31st, 2019. This is part of a five-part segment where he recorded highlights from the conference. In this segment, you will hear his interview with Tom Ruai, senior correspondent researcher, Siena College, about his workshop on education for liberation, teaching in the freedom school model. Take it away, Mr. Terry.
Yeah, this is Willie Terry, your WOOC, Roman labor correspondent for the Hustle Mohawk magazine. And I'm here at the Siena College at the Underground Railroad conference, a workshop called Education for Liberation, Teaching in the Freedom School Model, being run by Tom Rule.
Rule, yeah.
Okay. And who's a senior capstone researcher here at Siena College. How you doing?
Good, how are you?
All right. So you are conducting this workshop today. What is the major purpose or theme that you're trying to get out in this workshop?
What I was talking about in the workshop was my capstone presentation. So that was like my big research project before I can graduate as a senior here. So there were kind of two parts to the project that I wanted to convey in my presentation today. So the first was the research component. I wrote about a 40-page research paper on the Freedom Schools. So that's kind of just going over what they were, why they were necessary, and then the effect that the Freedom Schools had on both including the teachers, students, and the communities where the Freedom Schools were located. Because they had a pretty transformative effect on those communities. And then the second part is that I'm using what I learned, I'm using the research that I created to create like a curriculum type thing for a summer program that the Underground Railroad History Project is putting on to kind of continue teaching in the Freedom School model to empower students.
So how would this curriculum work, you know?
Like the central focus of it would be voting rights, like as a history of voting rights from the end of the Civil War and Reconstruction into now and all the issues that we still face with voting in this country. So the main goal is to have students examining primary source documents. So today in the workshop, I had the participants go through a document called What a Colored Man Should Do to Vote. And what that is, it's just like a summary of what person of color would need to do to vote in each of the states of the South. And there's a lot of pretty limiting requirements on there, like you have to live in a town for 2 years before you can have the right to vote there. If you can't recite your state's constitution from memory, then you can't vote there. If you can't name all of the county judges in your state, then you can't vote there. So some pretty serious barriers are put in place, and the document, the pamphlet that I gave in the presentation today kind of outlines what those obstacles are so you can try and avoid them and hopefully be able to register to vote.
So you're saying that obstacles kind of still exist to keep people from voting in the country, or just maybe Maine is still in the South, because you concentrated on Mississippi.
Yeah, so the central focus of my research was Mississippi, as that's where Freedom Summer in 1964, that's where the thing was taking place. These are enduring issues in the whole country. I would say one of the biggest would be gerrymandering, kind of deciding election districts based on who lives there so that you can kind of orchestrate who's going to win elections. That's still an issue in pretty much every state that we're facing. But then there's also, we saw a lot of issues in Georgia in this past election with voter suppression, trying to suppress voters of color, making it difficult for voters of color to get to the polls to actually participate in the elections. So as a whole country, there's still some issues we're facing, and then other parts of the country are facing larger issues.
So what would you call these today, if you set that up today, what would you call it? Would you still call it like a freedom school model, or would it be called something else today?
The main idea in the 60s when they were started was that they were going to try and basically give African Americans in Mississippi a better life, to empower them to make the necessary changes in society, to give them the right to vote, to kind of take the white supremacy in Mississippi kind of down a few pegs so that it would be more equal society. And there's still a lot of work that needs to be done to achieve that. But without Freedom Summer, Freedom Summer really got the ball rolling, not just in Mississippi, but across the country too. Like this is when we really start to see the civil rights movement start to really expand.
Mm-hmm. Have you looked into Mississippi recently in terms of there's a place called Jackson, Mississippi?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Do you know about that?
I mean, I'm familiar with the city, but I don't know much about what's going on there.
Jackson, Mississippi, you know, they have a progressive politics. They elected a guy who was a socialist, took over. And Jackson, Mississippi, they is supposed to be very progressive.
Mm-hmm. Good for them.
Was that a place where the Freedom School was operating? Was it, or what part of Mississippi? I mean,
so there were Freedom Schools throughout the state. They would kind of try and shoot for population centers. So there were 40 Freedom Schools in 19 counties of Mississippi, or 19 towns and counties of Mississippi. So Hattiesburg, I believe, was the largest. They had the most Freedom School students. And I think they actually had two Freedom Schools in the city of Hattiesburg. So like Jackson had Freedom. Every major city in Mississippi would have had a Freedom School, at least one, if not more. And then they also would go into rural communities as well. And those were the ones where it was more county-based. It would be a county Freedom School and people would come from all over.
What would the response from the white residents to the Freedom School? What were they?
Definitely not happy with what was going on. I guess that would be a generalization. I'm sure some people were okay with it. But at the very start of Freedom Summer, like right as soon as the first wave of volunteers get there, three of them are murdered by white supremacists. Tons of Freedom School volunteers and teachers were arrested and then subsequently beaten in jail or during the arrest. The white community in Mississippi was generally not very happy about it. And the white volunteers were immersing themselves in the black community. They were living with communities of color in Mississippi. So they weren't really with the white community. And because of that, there was a separation. So the white community in a specific area would know who the Freedom School teachers were, and they would be treated the same way that people of color would have been treated by those white people. So they were considered by a lot of white Mississippians to be kind of like traitors to the white race or whatever, mm-hmm. And they did not appreciate these Northerners coming down to Mississippi to try and change the way things were.
Do you know if any students in Siena was part of that movement back in that time?
That's a good question. I'm actually not sure. I do not know. Generally, they came from like more prestigious schools in Siena, not to knock Siena, but a lot of them came from Stanford, Yale, Harvard, like the big name schools in the 60s.
So how would you assess the voting situation in, let's say, in this area?
So I'm not from this area, so I don't know if I would be the best to speak about it. I mean,
from New York?
I'm from New York, but downstate.
Okay, well, how do you assess New York period?
Okay. I would say there's still not enough people registered to vote. Not enough people who are registered to vote are actually voting. I mean, ideally, every single person should be voting in every election, not just for the president, not just for your senator or whatever, but local elections matter just as much, if anything, more change happens at the local level than the federal level. So I would say we're going to have a problem with our elections until everyone's participating.
But you notice that there's upstate, downstate.
Yes, there's a big divide.
It's a lot of conflict. But there are progressive politicians being elected based on, you know, votes coming from downstate.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think about the current New York State government in terms of...
I mean, it kind of favors me and my beliefs, so I'm okay with it, I guess, but it's really not an ideal situation because there are a lot of New Yorkers who kind of do get overpowered by the downstate New York City, like, vote, basically. So there's just more people downstate, and they have a lot of differing viewpoints from a lot of the more upstate communities. I mean, there is a divide there. But at the end of the day, I think we got to do what the majority of people want, and the majority of New Yorkers happen to live downstate. So it just kind of works out that way.
Why did you think that the Underground Railroad Company would be a place to present this workshop? Why do you think this was the venue to present this, as opposed to going into a community and presenting?
Well, I was actually asked by Paul and Mary Liz to do this workshop, so that's why I would do it. But I think there would be a tremendous benefit for doing it in a community as well, because, like I was saying, until everyone is voting, we're not going to really be, our government is not truly going to represent the people unless all the people are voting. So by doing this workshop in a community, I would hope that I could encourage people who either aren't registered to vote to register, and people who maybe are registered but don't vote to get out to the polls in the next election.
A lot of people talk about voter education, you know. And I guess that's what they was doing during the Freedom School, in the Freedom School movement down in the South. They was, you know, when they was educating people, they also educated them about who to vote for, what, how to vote, right?
Mm-hmm.
I guess they did that.
Yeah.
And you think that that would be a process that could be used up here in oppressed communities to vote education, to really educate them, because a lot of people don't vote, and they don't mm-hmm. say, why should I vote? They don't kind of see how that connection, but they know that they should vote, mm-hmm. but they don't see what the connection that really helping them.
I do think it is important to relay to people how voting impacts an individual's life, because whether you vote or not, the policies that those politicians are going to create are going to have some sort of impact on you. It might be minor or it could be big, but the laws that are made in our society are going to have an effect on us no matter what. So I think more people should be voting like that. But voter education can be risky, because if you're educating voters in a good way with information that's pertinent to them in their lives, I would say that's good. But then it kind of opens the door for someone to come in with like disinformation. And I would hate to see someone come in to try and educate voters with stuff that's just not true. So that could be dangerous. I think ideally every voter should, or every citizen should, take it upon themselves to stay informed in the issues that are going to affect them. And then make their own decisions.
But young people, how do we get young people involved in this process?
I know, yeah. So that's one very frustrating for me. I mean, I'm only 22 years old, and I know a lot of my peers aren't voting. They don't really take an interest in politics. And I find that incredibly frustrating, because we're the ones that have our whole lives ahead of us.
Right.
And we're going to be dealing with these issues for probably the next 50, 60 years of our lives. And I mean, if we don't start making the changes that we want to see now, it's only going to become more difficult for us to do it when we are like in power, when we're the old crowd. So I think we got to start now. I think I think every American should vote, period, regardless of age, race, religion, whatever. But I would love to see more young people coming out to vote, because I think we have a really good idea for where we want the country to go. And
so how did your family take it that you're getting involved in this issue?
I do have a little bit differing political views than some of my family, but I mean, they've never discouraged me from what I'm doing. They've always supported the electoral process. Like, they instilled a love of democracy and voting in me. Like, I remember I was a kid and my parents would take me into the voting booth with them and everything. So really familiarized me with that from an early level. So they're definitely supportive, even if we don't always agree on what we're talking about.
Okay. Tom, just one last question.
Sure.
So is there anything that you would like to say in reference to your project that people should really know about?
I would say just look into the Mississippi Freedom Schools. They are an amazing thing that happened, and they're a completely overlooked part of civil rights history. I mean, really very few scholars are writing about this. Gets very overshadowed by the voting rights aspect of Freedom Summer. But in my opinion, I would say the Freedom Schools did just as much, if not more, to have a societal shift, to change the culture of Mississippi. I think the Freedom Schools were a huge part in that, and I think we should take a closer look.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, yeah,
Tom
of course.
Tom Roll, senior capstone researcher at Siena College, and hopefully we'll be hearing from you in the future about your project.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, that was Hudson Mohawk Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry, attended the Underground Railroad History Project Liberty.com conference at Siena College on March 20th to the 31st. This was part one of a 5-part segment where he recorded highlights from the conference. And that segment you heard from the opening speaker, Dr. Alan Singer, professor at Hofstra University. Next up is my own special segment that's near and dear to my heart, the Triple E's Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. I sat down with Terry the Dean Patterson, educator, TV personality. I really like this, single parent of a loving daughter, and talks about the importance of education and making a difference in the community. Take it away, Mr. Patterson. Hello again, everyone. This is H. Bosch Jr. with the Triple E segment, Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. Today's guest is Terry the Dean Patterson. Many of you know him as Dean Patterson. Welcome, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Well, we appreciate, Dean, you taking time out your busy schedule to stop by. I love having educators because you guys are truly, truly what I call the role models, the difference makers. So we're going to dig right into the show and start out with some rapid fire questions, should I say. Okay. All right. So, so you have a talk show. Tell us a little bit about it.
So before I go into that, if you don't mind, I want to tell you how it originated.
Okay.
So people say that, you know, you're either entering into a storm, you're in a storm, or you're coming out of one. But I think for me, last year in May, I was in a storm. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to figure out what was my next level, what was next for me to do, you know, in regards to my career. And I remember going to bed and praying about it and saying, hey, God, help me out. Give me a sign. Tell me something. And I woke up on May 30th. And I had a vision of the things that I do every day. I want to now put it on a bigger platform so many of my parents and students can actually see this information and hear it and change their lives, if you will. So Education Talk with the Dean show has been reborn. It's born now. So that's what the show is pretty much about. So the show is really about informing people so they can make better decisions, so they can have better lives, if you will.
Okay, so let me, that leads me into my next question then. So what makes your show different?
So I haven't seen many talk shows that really focus on education, if you will, and communities. Don't get me wrong, there are many of them that encompass all of these things, right? They have great games and great guests. So I was saying to myself, why can't we have fun about education? So when I have my slogan says education with a twist of laughter, that's where it comes in at.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So what are some of the titles of your show?
So if you don't mind, I'd like to go over the titles, if that's all right with
Absolutely.
You. Absolutely. So my first episode was the introduction of the show. And it was an intro to my vision. I started with a question, and it said, something happened this morning to you and to I. What was it? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, we woke up. I wanted to instantly. I wanted to instantly make a connection with people. Mm-hmm. Waking up is a blessing. Someone somewhere around the world did not. So because we woke up, we must do. Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure that, you know, I inform them of my mission, my vision, my purpose, and why.
So why?
So.
Yeah, you said you woke up. Yeah, you know we're gonna hit you with it.
Okay. Yep. So mm-hmm. so the question is why? You mm-hmm. ask why?
Right.
Well, everything in life starts with the why.
Absolutely. Right? What is my why? Yep. Why do we do what we do?
Why do you have this show? Why do I have mine, right?
Absolutely.
Well, the reason why I started my show is because I wanted to recognize that in today's society, there's a huge gap between individuals who are informed versus individuals who are uninformed mm-hmm. as it relates to understanding. So this show increases the awareness. So that's why I'm doing this.
Okay.
I wanted to increase the awareness.
Mm-hmm. Good, good. So, so who will you have on your show?
So on my show, I'm going to interview guests whose area of expertise mm-hmm. or experience will engage, challenge, and assist viewers' understanding.
Okay.
I want to give voice to all stakeholders who still believe in the transformative power of people talking with each other to learn, to teach, and to lead better lives.
Wow.
So that's
I really see your passion.
Thank you so much.
I see it. So how important is it to be informed? You know, because a lot of people don't realize mm-hmm. the importance of being truly informed.
Well, you know what? It's very important to be informed. And I want to add involved as well. Mm-hmm. So informed and involved. As I mentioned, I'm a parent. So
Single parent.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Black man raising a daughter. I like that. Yes, I like that.
And pray for me.
She
pray
turns
for me.
Out, look, apples don't fall far from the tree. She seems like she's a splendid young lady.
Thank you so much. Thank you so mm-hmm. much. So, you know, being a parent, I've made many mistakes myself.
Okay.
Because I wasn't informed.
And we didn't get a blueprint.
Right.
See,
right.
Toys, you buy stuff, even a phone, you get a blueprint on how to use it. They don't give us a blueprint mm-hmm. on how to be a parent. It's trial and error, mm-hmm. you know?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, there was a time when I made many mistakes, not just for myself, but for my family as well, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am those families that I serve today, all my students and their families. So I understand them. I understand their needs. So that's why it's so important to be involved and informed.
Okay. So now, how do you do that?
Two words. Relationship building.
Okay.
That's key in my world.
Mm-hmm.
Building relationships with students and families and educators is most important. It's the paramount or the blueprint, if you will, to, I would say, success.
Okay. So then, please tell us how people can get And well, before we even go to that, this is what I love to ask educators, all right? Let me fall back and ask you some questions that I'm sure a young man out listening to this show says, wow, you know, what I heard in these next couple of questions changed my life. What's the last book you read?
The last book I read was Start With Why.
Okay.
Start With Why.
Okay. Give me three of your favorite books that you've read.
T.D. Jakes.
Okay.
Reposition Yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Joel Osteen.
Mm-hmm.
And Mindset and Growth Set.
I like that. You see, because there's a young man or a young woman out there listening like, wow. They're going to leave, you know, because they look at who you are, what you become, and they see some of the books you've read that crafted and molded, you know, your vision on the world. Mm-hmm. So I always ask that. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to have a little fun. Go
Uh-oh.
Back.
Uh-oh.
All right.
Uh-oh.
What was your favorite TV show growing up?
My favorite TV show growing up, I want to say was...
Because this is going to date you.
Yeah. Everybody already know I'm old. No. My favorite television show, I want to say, was Good Time.
Okay.
Good Times is one of my all favorites.
Oh, okay. Good Times. Yeah. What's your favorite show right now, currently?
My favorite show right now, American Soul, which is a tribute to Cornelius,
is,
right?
That is a great, great,
because I didn't know much about him.
Series, yeah.
I didn't know much about him, okay. So learning through this way here, I get a
bigger
picture.
And it's pretty accurate.
Yeah,
it's pretty accurate.
Well, yeah. It seems to be.
Yes.
So I'm able to get a bigger picture or a sense of his struggles that he came through
and,
to get his
and
show.
How he was a maverick, a pioneer in what he went up against. Mm-hmm. And it's shameful that they don't have more about him in our schools.
Right,
you know,
right.
He changed the landscape of American music, mm-hmm. the way we know it, you know?
Absolutely,
and
absolutely.
Not only did he put, I would say, African-American music on the landmark or on the map, mm-hmm. but he did it in a dignifying, in a classy way. You know, my hat's mm-hmm. off to him. I mean, I can't, you know, next week is the last two episodes.
I'm looking forward to it.
I'm hanging on
to
every
it. I'm
word.
Looking forward
yes.
to it.
Yes, yes.
But
all
it's
right.
a very good production, a very uh-huh. good production.
So what's, give me your favorite movie.
My favorite movie, I have so many.
Okay.
See,
because this will let people know a little bit about the person who
right,
they
right,
see
right.
every day, you know, other than just Dean Patterson, you know, go here, go there.
And
I'll
tell you, my students and my families, they know my whole life story. They know me.
Right.
Favorite movie? There are so many movies out there.
What's your last movie you watched that you really enjoyed?
The last movie that I watched that I enjoyed was Get Out.
Get Out.
Get
okay.
Out, you know.
Okay.
That
was with...
That was a young man, I forgot, Key and Peele.
Right.
And he has
right,
another one out right. now called Us Now.
Okay.
I like what he's doing with his movies. He's changing the game
yep.
with his movies.
Again, another trailblazer.
Yep.
Yeah, another trailblazer, another maverick.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, doing it with a positive spin.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what really, really... I enjoy that, just like I said, having educators like yourself. So give us a little history about your educational background, where you mm-hmm. came from before we close out.
So went to school, went to college, if you will,
mm-hmm.
got my associate's in accounting, got my bachelor's in accounting, and I got my MBA, of course, in business. And I got at a later age in my life because
mm-hmm.
there was a time where I was not able to go to college. Straight after high school, I wasn't able to go. Financial concerns, if you will, or
okay.
restraints, if you will.
And how did you get out of that? And I'm sure you were raised in a challenging neighborhood.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm not ashamed of where I come from.
Okay.
I'm from it. That's
which I'm going to lead to my
that's
next
why
question.
I know how to deal with it
okay.
and make sure my people are better when it comes to that.
Mm-hmm.
Through trial and error, you know, I'm wanting to do better, making a promise to myself that when I'm able to go back to college, go.
Mm-hmm.
And I made that promise to myself at a later age, and I went. There was a time I was taking my daughter with me to school, putting her in one area while I was going to class because
come on,
I had
speak,
to let her
speak,
see
speak,
what
yes.
her father had to go through.
Right.
You know,
right,
or what
right.
what needs to happen
and
for her life.
And building legacy.
Exactly.
Yes, building
so,
legacy.
So that's what I did, you know, to make sure I came through.
So as an educator, let me ask you, who was your favorite teacher that really inspired you? That really touched you, looked and saw something in you that you didn't see in yourself?
There was a young lady, her name was Miss LaVal. And hopefully she's hearing it so she can give me some kudos for that. Miss LaVal, she believed in me
mm-hmm.
when no one else did. She sat me down and asked me, young man, what's wrong with you? Why are you so angry? Why do you have so much anger inside of you? So she took the time out to get to know who I was. And that changed my life. So I'm forever indebted to her for asking me why.
Okay.
And helped me understand the reason why I'm feeling this way and how to channel that energy to another location.
Give me some mentors and some role models that, you know, helped shape you during the formative years. Because I know someone like you, you had to have some. A lot of people reached out and touched you to say, look, go this way, go that way. Mm-hmm. You know,
I want to say my mother first and foremost. Oh, you know, she absolutely put the stamp on it.
Okay.
Family put the stamp on it. I want to say everybody who passed through my life, they still have a piece on me somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
They was able to kind of allow me to help them. So if I'm able to help them, I was able to become successful. So I want to say all of them, they all encompass really helping me out as that.
They all share in that success.
Exactly, exactly.
Everybody has a little piece of you.
Exactly, yeah.
But it begins and ends with mom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Start at home.
Okay. So how's it feel raising such a great daughter? And tell me some of the challenges you've had, you know?
If anybody who knows, if you have a daughter in 2019,
And I'll tell you, I went from this, okay? It happened and it came upon me, certainly, all right, and real quick. And when I was going through the process, the judge says, you sure? I says, yes, Your Honor. And he says, really? I said, well, look, I go from chasing a woman to raising a woman. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I said, you know, I go from chasing a woman to now I'm raising a woman. And it was challenging. And it can be challenging. But there's nothing like when little girls grow up and they talk about their dads. Because oftentimes we don't get that in the same conversation.
I will tell you, though, it's not easy.
Yep.
Raising a daughter, of course, from a male perspective.
And I'm sure she's going to say, it's not easy.
Being with dad.
Being his daughter.
but you know, the good thing about this whole thing is that even my students are my sons and my daughters.
Yes.
So I raise them accordingly. So I talk to them the way I talk to my own daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents need to know that their children are my children when they're in my vicinity, right? When they're in front of me. So I'm learning through them to help raise my daughter as well, better as well, too.
Okay.
So they are helping me raise my daughter better.
Oh,
right? Because
wow.
I'm seeing what they're doing. I'm coming back home and having conversations with my daughter and I about the do's and the don'ts, if you will, and what daddy expects, right? So for the most part, I'm able to grow not just my own, but somebody else's.
So before we close out, I want to ask two more quick questions.
Sure.
Please tell us how people can contact you.
So we are on YouTube. YouTube, the name is Education Talk with the Dean Show. Facebook is terry.patterson.530.
Okay.
Twitter, we are at The Dean Talks.
Okay.
LinkedIn, we are Terry The Dean Patterson. On my Gmail address is thedeanshow530@gmail.com.
Okay. So as we close, what do you want to say to your students, parents, and educators?
The word is I'm possible, not impossible.
I like that. I like that. Well, listen, Dean Patterson, it has been a plum pleasing pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
I hope I did you proud.
Oh, you did me very proud.
And please don't be a stranger. You know, come back soon when the book goes out and you're doing the tour. Swing by and
absolutely,
holler.
Okay? Absolutely.
All right.
Can't forget where I started. Right
thank
here.
You. Continued blessings.
Thank
Until
you.
Next time, folks, it's about the triple E's: education, empowerment, entrepreneurship. And remember this, don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy, H. Bosch Jr., doing what I'm made to believe. All right, that was Terry, the Dean Patterson, who stopped by and graced us with a phenomenal interview. I mean, once again, what he's doing in this area, and he didn't have to come to Albany. I mean, he was extremely recruited all over the country, but he chose Albany, New York, the 518, to come and give his talent. So you need to reach out on Facebook and really introduce yourself to this guy, because he's a remarkable, remarkable individual that's doing some great, great things. Now, in our next segment, all right, we sit down with Imani Taylor. Okay, in the 10th segment of a series on technology and its impact on different generations, HMM correspondent Miss Imani, my right arm, Taylor, speaks with our own Elizabeth Press, better known as Simply EP.
This is Imani Taylor, and I'm speaking with Elizabeth Press, also known as EP. How are you today?
Good. How are you? Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for being here. Could you tell me a little bit about yourself? What do you do for work? Some of your hobbies?
Sure. I'm a lecturer in the arts department at RPI. I've been teaching up in the Capital District since 2015, and before that, worked professionally in media. Some of my hobbies are, I like to garden. I like to play with toddlers. I make, you know, silly stop animations. Home construction projects.
Nice.
Things like this.
Nice. Okay. So EP, would you say that you grew up in the computer era? Whatever that means to you.
That's an interesting question. I feel like I grew up as someone who assimilated to the computer era. I didn't have the technology that kids have today in my life, but I use technology a lot today.
And do you mind sharing how old you are?
Wow, we're getting personal quick, huh? I would say I'm, you know, I was like thinking about this. Am I, you know, these categories of people like baby boomers, Gen Xers, millennials. Do you consider yourself a millennial?
I thought I was a millennial, but I was informed recently that apparently I'm the next level, whatever that is.
Is that Z?
I have no idea. Okay, my friend's nodding, so apparently I'm Z.
You're Z. I feel like I'm X.
Okay. I know what none of these terms mean, if I'm being honest.
Really? Well, I don't know if we necessarily know what they mean, but definitely they're, I feel like, labels to group different generations of people in their engagement with technology, right? What we're talking about today.
Yeah.
I'm in my 40s.
Thank you.
So 41 to be exact.
41. That's a good age. Okay. How old were you when you got your first cell phone?
I got my first cell phone in probably the end of 1998. I just start of 1999. It was a Nokia. It's a big block phone. I don't quite remember exactly what it was. I had just finished college.
I was a wee babe.
Mm.
So you said it was a block phone?
Yeah. So I don't know. Do you know, maybe a few years later, you're probably still a baby. I think my second phone was Sony Ericsson Walkman. So the Walkman was like sort of based off of technology that was going away at that time, which had radio capacity and you could play MP3s on it. But the Nokia, basically, you could talk on. Mm-hmm. And you could send, if you were really patient, some text messages.
So how do you use your phone now? I'm assuming you have a smartphone now. How do you use it differently from your first cell phone?
Yeah, way differently. I think my main use for my phone these days is to, you know, see what's going on in the world. I use it a lot for podcasts that I stream. I use it also to check in on what's happening in the world, different news sites, et cetera, and texting as well, email.
Great.
It's a small computer now.
And going into computers, what about computers? Did you use a computer when you were in school?
What do you mean by when I was in school? Like grade school, elementary school?
Obviously, I know you did not use one in grade school.
Yeah.
So I guess for you, it might be your college years.
Right. So when I think about computers, I think about early on, maybe I can't exactly name a date, but I think of like these big bulky computers. I think of, you know, probably late middle school playing games like Oregon Trail on the computer. I think about dial-up. I think about my younger cousins who would rush home from school. I miss this, but they would have the dial-up connection and get on AOL Messenger. Mm-hmm. These are sort of like my early computer memories. I don't think I had my own email address till 1995 when I went away to college. But I do remember during high school, we did get, it was either an IBM or a Texas Instrument computer with a dot matrix printer. So I would be able to type up at the end of high school some of my papers on there.
So you used it for your education?
For education, yeah, for sure.
Did your teachers, like, were they pushing the use of computers at that time in class?
Well, it was very separate, if I can recall correctly. It was, we had a computer class. So in computer class, we would learn, we'd play games where you see how fast you can type. We would play different computer games, like I think I mentioned Oregon Trail. But in the classes itself in high school. I think you had to start toward the end of high school typing up papers to turn them in. So that was more integration into English, social studies, et cetera.
Okay. And what did you study in college?
I studied photography and anthropology.
So I'm sure computers proved to be useful then.
Yeah, there were 24-hour computer labs. We used them all the time.
And what about now? Do you use computers in your workplace?
Definitely. I edit a lot of video, so and audio, and work in media. So you have to. That's why I said earlier, I think I'm of a generation that has assimilated. I have taken on the parts of technology and computers and phones that I find are important to me. But maybe like someone from who's a bit younger than me might really be much more involved in social media than I would say I am. I use it in a utilitarian sort of fashion instead of as an everyday sort of activity.
So how's the technology in your field specifically developed?
I mean, technology is constantly developing. At RPI, we have a new media studio where, you know, I've been working in TV for over a decade before coming here. And, you know, now there's these new connections. You go from SDI connections to NDI connections, which allow you to have cameras remotely in the field from anywhere, and you can connect over the internet or a set network connection. So the technology is sort of constantly evolving, whether it's editing software, cameras, equipment for live productions. So you want to stay on top of what is changing so that you can be relevant.
What sort of equipment did you have when you were learning how to photograph and edit video?
Oh, definitely. We just had non-digital single lens reflex cameras. We had some camcorders. We had analog video editing that we switched over, you know, probably 5 years into editing. I started using nonlinear editing software. And then, but, you know, I was thinking back to 1999. I did my graduate work at RPI in the arts department. And I also taught an after-school program here in Troy. And we taught analog editing at the after-school program.
Nice.
Yeah, so it was, you know, at that time when it was constantly changing and developing from linear to nonlinear.
Cool. So kind of answered this, but if you can think of anything else to say more broadly, how has technology impacted your life?
I mean, I feel like I did answer this, but I feel like technology I see as a tool. I see it as a way to express and help with creative expressions. And I feel like as, you know, technology develops, our reliance on it for the things we're interested in are going to adjust to that and grow with that. And it's necessary, right? Like it's for what I do in my career, it's necessary to stay on top of what's going on.
Great. Okay, last question, which you kind of hinted at earlier. Are you on social media and how do you feel about it?
I am on social media. I feel like when I was freelancing in New York City and working for different blogs, I was much more on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all of these sort of platforms to promote the work that we were doing. I feel like I don't have that same need to promote the work that I'm doing on these different social media platforms. And I find for personal use, I don't find a lot of need for it. But I'm still have a presence there, a very small presence, an account.
Okay. Well, that's all the questions I have for you. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, you've been doing the series for some time, so you've talked to a bunch of different people. Do you feel like you could sort of like categorize or summarize some of the things that you're getting out of doing this series? Like, is there a general thing, like someone from like the baby boomer generation, what they're like, or a millennial, or like, does it matter based off of how old someone is, their relationship to technology?
Yeah, so the youngest I've gotten is Trayvon, one of our own here at the Sanctuary. I think he's 13 now. And he's, you know, he didn't really have much to say other than technology is cool and I like to play games. And then he did talk about how it's used in school too. Definitely the younger generations are using technology more in school. As far as like my generation goes, I've spoken to a few RPI students their opinions, obviously they see it as kind of like they need it to function, right? Because mm-hmm. like I said, we're using it and it's highly pushed in education, kind of hard to get an education without technology these days. Like even when I was in high school, I did go to a pretty privileged private high school, but we were provided with iPads and now they're providing the students with MacBooks. And it's just, you need the internet at the very least to do research, to get anything done. So it's kind of a need. And then for your age and above, I've found that like with the social media, they're like, it's there, but it's not as big of a part of their life as the younger generations. And they're able to talk about how the technology has developed like since it first started, which I think is cool to get a perspective on. And they mostly talk about it like as you did, as more like a tool. I guess one thing that everyone I've interviewed has in common is they all like it. Technology is useful, like it's a good tool. But mm-hmm. then I've also, in regards to social media, there are some flaws, to say the least.
Cool. Thanks for sort of wrapping that up for me. I was curious, like what you've been learning.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much for participating.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay. That was Imani Taylor. All right. Closing out the technology series. All right. Now, let me, before I close out, go back to some announcements again. Once again, upcoming guests will have a representative from the American Heart Association talking about their May 16th luncheon at the CAP Center. Also in May, I'll have the legendary Doc Perryman. We will also have Miss Carmen Duncan on talking about Mission Accomplished, as well as Mr. Malik Ray talking about the fourth annual Black Wall Street. I'll be hosting that event, as well as May 5th, which is a Sunday, at the Women's Club on Madison Avenue. Allie B, she's giving a lunch, a brunch, and I'll also be the host there, as well as the event that Saturday before the 5th in Washington Park on pulmonary embolism. Oh, I'm this word. Somebody say that for me, all right? But anyway, I'll be the host there. Miss Lavonia Mallory is sponsoring it. It's going to be a dedication on her brother. They're going to dedicate a tennis court on his behalf. He died early as a result of that disease that took his life at such an early age. So I think I just wrapped up everything, so we're going to close it out. All right. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr., the hippest, hottest, baddest host in America. Our engineer tonight is none other than the incomparable Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook. If you have any comments, suggestions, or tender confessions, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in at 7 and 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary and a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. Okay, as a reminder, this is the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. It is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at infomediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings held right here Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Once again, folks, until next time, this is H. Bosch Jr., the hippest, hottest, baddest host in America. Thank you for tuning in.